Hello, Team Builder. Thank you so much for joining us today on Ask Michelle and Chris. We're here to answer your questions about team building so we can learn and grow together. I'm your host, Chris Cabot, of Fun Doing and On Team Building. I'm joined by my co-host, Michelle Cummings of Training Wheels. Let's go find out what we can answer for you today. Hello, Michelle.
Hey, Chris. How's it going?
Always good.
Yeah.
Always good to see you. Now, where are we? We're at the
Training Wheels headquarters.
Headquarters.
Home office.
Yes, home office. Because we now know that Training Wheels has a warehouse and office at another location.
It is,
so
yeah.
It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Expanding. But it's all good. It's things in Colorado are wonderful. You just got back from a trip.
Yeah.
You know, so you're out and about.
All the
getting
time.
Getting things done.
Yeah.
I've been doing trainings for you and some writing, so that's been really fun. So yeah.
Yeah.
I'm doing well. Yourself?
Yeah, doing good. Yeah. It's just kind of, this is the busy season where it's out and back, out and back, out and back, whether it be for conferences or for client work or whatever. But yeah, this is definitely the busy season.
Yeah.
So
we get energy from those conferences.
Yeah.
I know our Boulder conference was fun.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good. It's good to be here. Good to be working with you and the team. It's just fun.
It's just
like-minded people.
Yeah.
Good energy. So we're been kind of on a roll around activities.
Yeah.
Activities in this way of building.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm looking forward to this episode.
Yeah, this will be fun. This will be fun.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get enough people to create new ones and send it to us.
Yeah. So we kind of started two episodes back with like game changing. Like, how do you, all of a sudden you show up, you've had a plan, all of a sudden you show up and instead of 20 people, you've got 80. Or maybe you thought you were going to be outside, but then you're going to be inside. So how do you then change your plan, change the game plan to meet whatever is presented to you? Then the next episode after that was around tweaking a game towards a specific outcome.
Right. We know the outcome. What do we have? What do we know?
And
how do we make it work to be able to reach that outcome?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then today we're going to be talking about how to create a new activity from the bottom up.
My favorite.
Whether it be you found this new cool prop or this something that you're like, ooh, how could I use that in team building? And you create a new game from that doesn't exist from the thing. Or it could also be you're designing a game towards a specific outcome.
Yeah, something new.
Something new.
Something new.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my favorite topic.
Mm.
It's just, I'm more of a, I have some things I've created, but it's more about changing, like our second episode, changing an activity to meet an outcome. And we know, we have friends that have done this before. And I think you've got our first example of a good friend of ours who just is one of those creative minds that come up with things. Out of the blue.
Absolutely. So if you do not know the name Sam Sykes, then you need to get a hold of several of his books and read them. So Sam has one of those creative brains that I just love to be around Sam because then he just has all kinds of great ideas around how to build out new activities. And I use several of Sam's original creation activities on a pretty regular basis. So the one we're going to talk about today that I think is not necessarily new to the industry, but Sam is the one that first started using mousetraps in our field and created 6 or 7 different activities. And he wrote up all of them in his book, Raptor. Raptor and Other Team Building Activities by Sam Sykes. This came out in 2003. So it's been out a little while, but that when he first came out with mousetraps, all of us were like, what? Are you kidding? We're going to ask our participants to handle and play with mousetraps. And I think my favorite mousetrap activity that I have gotten so much mileage out of his is the mousetrap trust sequence, where now, first and foremost, you have to have the right mousetraps. Now, I have been a connoisseur of the different brands of mousetraps that are out there. And my favorite is the Victor Metal Pedal Mousetrap. So don't use the ones with the plastic cheese. Like, I just don't like those as much. But the Metal Pedal Mousetrap is by far, in my opinion, the best mousetraps to use. So The Mousetrap Trust Sequence has five phases to it. Now, you don't have to do all five phases with the group, but phase one is just teaching your participants how to safely set a mousetrap. So for me, I go through all the parts. You know, I call the wooden part is the base, where the big red letter V is on the Victor mousetrap. That is the safety zone on the mousetrap. That is where the thumbs go. Like if you're going to be handling a mousetrap, handle it in the safety zone. And then the gate is the metal part that kind of
Called the hammer.
the hammer, yes, that slams over, that has that coil on it, and that's what actually hits the mouse when if it's
Yes.
being used for its traditional use. And then the little arm that has the little crook in it, and then the hook. The hook is where you would put the peanut butter or the cheese or whatever it is that you're using if you're using it for mice. And so phase one is just getting your group comfortable with setting the mousetrap. And I always tell them, you have to be very comfortable with phase one before we move to phase two. And then before I move to phase two, I have everyone put, say, I say traps down, and everyone puts their traps on the table or on the ground, because otherwise they're just going to keep messing with them while they're talking to you. And sometimes that's when people might get their fingers snapped if they aren't. If they're distracted, they're trying to listen to you, but they're also handling things. So that's for me personally, that's what I do. Before I move to phase two. And what I love about what Sam did with mousetraps is he really wanted to create the same experience, feelings, emotions that somebody would get if they were on a 50-foot climbing tower. How can you create anxiety? How can you create fear in a controlled, safe environment like inside or a boardroom or something like that with a corporate client that, you know, we can't go to a, you know, maybe they couldn't go to the ropes course, or maybe the heart attack risk was too high or whatever it is. But he wanted to create that same kind of experience. And so that's where the mousetrap came into play. So phase one, get comfortable setting it. Phase two is setting the mousetrap with your eyes closed. So after, and then you have a coach. So you always do this in pairs. And so one person kind of coaches the person how to set the mousetrap or watching them. And I always say it's a hands-off experience. It's verbal coaching, not physical coaching and physical assistance. So that's phase two. And then both participants experience both roles as the setter and the coach. And then phase three is, and then in between phases, then I have them put traps down. We debrief that, and then and talk about what that was like, which role was more difficult, and whatnot. And then I always do a team breath in between after, in between the roles before we start phase three. I'm like, all right, let's do a big team breath. Which I got that phrase from Tom Leahy. I use that really often. And then stage three is then learning how to unset a live mousetrap using your hand. And so for this one, I have everyone, it's eyes open, and you take a mousetrap and you set it with your eyes open, and then you lay it in your outstretched palm of your hand. And then with your other hand, for me, it's my right hand. I usually put my mousetrap in my left hand, and it's sitting there, it's live. I take my right hand and I hover it over the top of that live mousetrap. And then keeping your hands just straight and flat, I call it the mousetrap sandwich. So if my hands were the bread and the mousetrap is the meat, then all of a sudden you go straight down,
Slowly,
slow. I do it. I can do
slowly.
it fast.
Go. I've had
You do.
some injuries
Oh,
by
really?
their hands getting poked by the little arm
Oh, huh.
latch. So I say slowly because it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
As soon as you press this two
Yep.
pieces of bread together, it will catch everything.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
So then,
my experience,
yeah,
yeah.
hands together. And then as soon as you lift up that top hand, the mousetrap will unset and release underneath. And that is quite the adrenaline rush the first time that you do it. And so then again, both people experience both roles as the unsetter, I guess it would be in this one. And then traps down, debrief that round, team breath. And then phase four. Phase four is then a combination of phase one, two, and three, where then One person will close their eyes and they will set the trap, put it in their outstretched palm, and unset the trap all with their eyes closed. And the other, their partner then is coach verbally coaching them through that process.
Whew. Yeah.
And that's also can create some big anxiety and a lot of good things to debrief afterwards. So then after both people have done both roles, you debrief it, team breath. And then right there, that is a place where you can actually stop. You don't have to move on to phase five if you don't want to. And so for me, I kind of judge the group is, are they, can they handle phase five? Or is the outcome that we're looking at just to talk about how do you build trust? How do you accurately communicate? Like, kind of depends on what the desired outcomes of the group are. And then phase five could be a mousetrap obstacle course, if you will, where you put a rope down on the ground and then you set between 60 to 100 mousetraps and set them all live in this roped off area.
Have your participants help you now.
Yep, absolutely.
Because they know how to set a mousetrap.
Yeah. And then I have everyone take off their shoes. And then I have one person stand on one side of the roped off area. And the person that is walking through stands on the other side. And then whoever's walking through, now I don't have them close their eyes. What I have them do instead is take their two hands and place their hands right underneath, like almost make a little tent with their hand, with their fingertips together, and place them right underneath their eyes to where then they can't see their feet, but they can look across and they can see their coach.
Like blinders.
Yeah, kind of like blinders to it. And it's crazy. Do it right now, listeners, as you're doing it. Unless you're driving, don't do it then. But if you take your hands and just put them right, like kind of on your nose, if you will, and it really does. You cannot see below, you know, straight down.
And so I've done it without blinders by just looking across at your partner, and your goal is to keep eye contact. Mm. And if you do look down, that's something to talk about. So
right.
It depends on your outcomes.
Yep.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then the goal is then to, for the coach to safely guide their person, their partner through the mousetrap obstacle without setting off any of the the mousetraps. Yeah. Now, a few things I do, I sometimes throw like a little funny in. I'm like, okay, let's do a pinch and roll the jeans, because sometimes what might set off the trap would be jeans, like brushing a nearby trap. And so you don't want, you definitely, the sound is very scary if you're the one that's walking out there. So
it's an adrenaline rush, most definitely.
Yep.
That's definitely.
Yeah. So mousetrap might fail. It's a fan favorite. I have used that. I've gotten a lot of mileage out of that activity.
And thinking about that sequence that Michelle just talked about, is where did it start? As Michelle mentioned, Sam had an objective. And I remember his story is, I think it was part of, he worked on oil rigs. Mm. And he wanted to bring something that created some anxiety. So how did we work under anxiety? Mm. And he used mousetrap a lot with these guys. But that sequence of things that were developed were intentional. So what are your outcomes? Thinking about, here's an activity and what does it do? So that's how we create things from scratch, so to speak. I love to go to hardware stores, pet stores, game stores, and find things like, ooh, that could be a fun team building activity. So years ago, I was at a pet store in St. Joe, Missouri. Mm. Yeah, that's where I got the first ricochet balls. And found these three bouncy balls in the dog toy area. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I was buying things in threes. I was working with at-risk kids. And I was learning how to juggle. And I was teaching kids how to juggle. Because it was a skill that, it was something you could do that you got better at with practice. So it was one of those easy things. Usually with the kids we worked with, they were soft implements, like the yarn balls and the koosh balls at the time. So we would teach them how to juggle. Like, got these three knobby looking solid bouncy balls and, you know, learn how to juggle with them and was playing with them. And then they would fall and they would bounce. And so now you're finding something unexpectedly and all of a an idea comes to you. So you get something, you play with it, you do stuff with it and say, oh, this could be this. Then I got some of my colleagues together and we went out in front of where we lived and we played on the sidewalk and we bounced it. And the first game we created actually was called Popcorn, which turned into the game Ricochet. And that was the original competitive game of Ricochet where you toss the ball up and it has, it's like a, if you've known a super ball or anything solid rubber ball where you bounce it off the ground and it bounces pretty high, same kind of concept. Where with this ball, you'd toss it up and you'd bounce it on the cement and it would bounce in odd different patterns because of the bumps. And that inspired that name Ricochet because it was ricocheting. And then it ended up being this fun development of the names of things, the names of serves, the names of the things that the ball was doing. So it was really then became an activity that you like hacky sack. Remember when you learned hacky sack and then you were kicking it in? You became part of the in the know and how to do it. So that's what we taught our kids was, here, we're going to teach you this language. We're going to teach you the rules. We're going to teach you how to compete respectfully because we're serving for each other. You know, so that all turned into the same kinds of objectives we were working with our kids, but now it was an outdoor fun, interesting, competitive activity that was engaging. And then from there, you just develop other things at the ball, cooperative games, some other competitive games, how you make something that you know harder. So it evolves from taking a chance on something, buying something, or that could have some potential, bringing it home and playing with it, adapting it to what you already know how to do. Maybe you're changing a beach ball from a moon ball to a Gertie ball. You like to sell Gertie balls. And the Gertie balls make it a little more challenging to do moon ball because it drops faster.
Right.
You know, so how do you, we talked about that equipment in that in the game changing episode. You could find things that can be reused in other activities or just create something new based on the types of people that you work with.
Yeah.
And that was so fun. We had a lot of fun with that. And it's still going on today.
Yeah, absolutely. You've sold thousands of copies. Ricochet is fun. It's really fun. If you've not ever done it, I highly recommend you picking up a copy of the book and a few of the Ricochet balls and really fun. I think my favorite game of Ricochet I ever played was on a frozen pond.
Had to be with Brian.
It was with Brian Brolin. Yep. And I tell you what, we had so much fun that day. Like, it was just one of those days where it was the conditions were just right. A frozen pond. It was nice enough to be outside. And so Ricochet on concrete, on a solid surface, can be difficult. But Ricochet on a frozen pond takes it to a whole new level.
It's just how you think about it. Yeah. What you can do with it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, any activity, that's what you can do.
Yep.
What do you have? Another one. So this one's new.
This one is brand spanking new. I think maybe 7 people know about this game so far. This is a new game that I have engineered for what my new Personify program that it just came out this year. And it's the deep dive program for Personify. And in this program, I teach 8 core competencies of effective leadership. And one of the competencies that we teach in it is around effective delegation. And I have, you know, there's been this catchphrase out there forever. I did not create the catchphrase, but it's delegate what's on your plate, right? Like, and I'm just like, it's perfect because it rhymes. It's three words. It's so delegate what's on your plate. So I'm like, how could I actually then engineer a game that actually had people delegating what is on a plate? And so in this deep dive program, I'm really starting, the skill that I'm teaching in this module is around how to distinguish between high value tasks and low value tasks. Because, you know, leaders and organizations, they, once you get promoted to a people manager position where people report to you, it is then the part of your responsibility of being a leader or a manager of others is getting work done through others. So it's actually required of you to get work done through others. That's part of being a leader. So in the core program of Personify, we teach, you know, had to effectively delegate. We talk about the modes of delegation. We created three different modes of delegation. And so they already have that baseline knowledge of how to delegate. So now in the deep dive program, we're really wanting to teach them, how do you actually then determine what are the right tasks to delegate? So prior to doing this activity, we have them identify, like, and go into a little bit of self-reflection. What are some of your high-value tasks that are on your plate right now, and what are some of your low-value tasks? And I have them write them on a very specific card. And this card then has five different little pictures of little trinkets, everything from a little heart charm to a tiny koosh ball to a button to a little pencil eraser shaped like a penguin, you know, like just little tiny trinkets of some sort. And so they identify their high value tasks and five high value tasks and high low value tasks. Then they get a plate, literally a plate, because we're delegating what's on our plate. And then they go and they literally grab a handful of these trinkets and put it on their plate. And now they've got their high value tasks and their low value tasks. And then, so the activity then, what they have to do is they then have to walk around with their plate and their card, and they have to delegate the low value tasks that they already identified on their card with the little trinket that matches whatever it is to other people in the room. And so the skill that we're teaching there, that they start practicing, is really starting to get the words out of their mouth. So for example, one thing, a low value task for me at Training Wheels is I should not be the one that is fulfilling all of the orders that go out the door every day. So that's a low value task for me. Doesn't mean I can't do it, and I can absolutely step in when I need to do it. But that's a low value task because there's other people in the organization that should be doing that. It should not be me doing it. So if that's one of mine, then let's say I have a little tiny, maybe it's a little mini rubber chicken that I have that identified, that's the trinket next to shipping orders. Then I would walk up to somebody else, if I've got a little mini rubber chicken on my plate, and I would say, hey, Chris, I have identified right here, and I pick up the little mini chicken that is on my plate. I have identified that that shipping orders out of the warehouse every day is not necessarily a task that should be on my plate. And so I need to delegate this. Is that a task that you could take on right now? And then Chris will actually look at his card because he's got different pictures of different trinkets. He also has high value tasks and low value tasks written on him. If my rubber chicken, that is my low value task, matches a rubber chicken picture on his card that says it's also one of his low value tasks, then he said, actually, I'm not allowed to take any low value, any rubber chickens associated with low value tasks. So he actually might tell me no. And because, and that's what happens in real life, is that if I go to delegate someone, I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't have bandwidth to take that on right now. Or I'm sorry, I can't take that task from you. Okay, thank you for letting me know. And then I would go to somebody else and try to. The game itself is trying to get leaders to understand and how to find the words to delegate tasks off their plate, delegate things that are off their plate, knowing that your recipient may not accept your request or may not have the bandwidth or may not be able to do it. So how do we then continue to figure out how do I get work done through others when sometimes they say no?
Yeah.
And then we after that, we go back into the classroom, and then we talk about making sure that we're giving our delegates voice and choice. And so they get the experience of delegating what's on their plate through the activity, knowing then the next skill that I'm about to teach is how do we make sure that we don't just dump on people and say, Chris, here, you're getting all the shipping, when Chris is like, I actually can't take on more. I actually need to be delegating things myself. And so giving your delegates a voice and choice.
Nice.
So that's an example of how I really engineered this game from the bottom up, from the ground up, to a specific outcome in a bigger curriculum and it didn't happen overnight. This is one that I wrestled with for a really long time.
And inspired by a name.
Inspired by, delegate what's on your plate.
It's like, how does that work? Let's do a quick backwards, and you're going to read some of the activity titles that Sam put in the book about what we could make with
mousetraps. Oh, yes. Okay.
He said he shares some inspiration that maybe people will design games with mousetraps with these titles.
Yes. Here we go. So on page 6 of Raptor, it's the little title of this section is called What's in a Name? So below is a list of some of the names just waiting to attach new mousetrap activities to. All right, you ready? Here we go. Contraption. That's a good one. Trapezoid. Trapeze. Sand trap. Snapdragon. Lefty. Stub. Separation anxiety. It's only a flesh wound. Snap crackle pop. Snappy comeback or red snapper. So nice. There you go. There's some names that maybe
I've been in that same mindset of, oh, that's a cool name. I got to come up with something.
Yes.
You know, it's just a fun way, another way to design something. You have a title and you want to build something around it. So it's inspiration.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right, you got one more. Close us out, Chris.
One more. I think we're good. And this will work. I enjoy books. I like to read, but I have a hard time reading for a long period of time. So I look for books that have shorter types of chapters with takeaways. And one set of my favorites come from Ryan Holiday, and he writes about Stoic philosophy. And in one of his books called The Obstacle is the Way, there's just short chapters and they're lessons. They're Stoic lessons. Most of them have stories about other people in history. So really kind of interesting learning and takeaways for me. And The Obstacle is the Way, as I was reading, I'm always taking kind of underlining things, highlighting things, saving quotes. And as I'm going along, I'm realizing that in my brain, it just popped in, this needs to be a set of cards that we can share with others that have these obstacle type quotes on them to make us think about obstacles or challenges or what we call problem solving activities, running into problems. And as I've been using them, I collected them, and there are three sections of the book, one called perception, one called will, and one called action. And this is how we look at obstacles. It's first your perception of things, how you perceive it. What's the initial perception? Could that change as a way to solve the obstacle? Then there is, okay, now we perceive it this way. What is your will to change it? If it's something you want to change, what kind of will, what kind of strength do you have to get through that and around over into the obstacle, solve it and go through it. And then the last is your action. It's like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do about it? Mm-hmm. And using these quotes, we've been talking about this perception, will, and action in figuring out what each quote kind of fits. So it makes us think and relate back to what part of an obstacle or attacking an obstacle is this quote. So it's created some wonderful conversations about how we think about problems, which then leads me, it's a nice front-loading activity, which then leads me into, as we go to solve a problem as a group, we can look at, well, where are we at? Perception? Are we at the will stage? How are we going to get through that? And what action are we going to take? You know, where are we? So we start bringing this conversation back to what we're doing physically, as opposed to thinking about something cognitively. So it was very serendipitous, because as we learn more and more activities, we get used to how they work and operate, and then we start thinking that way. And then you read a book and you pull out, ooh, that would be a good processing question, or that would be a good question as an icebreaker. Or so you get that kind of habit of cultivating things out of either things you read, movies that you see, conversations you have with other people. You can kind of get some of that, like little nuggets of gold, and bring them into your activities or create an activity around something that you read, seen, or heard.
Yeah.
You know? So it was a fun one, and it's been very popular. I've gotten a lot of good comments on it just because of its teaching that mindset.
Yeah.
So it was really fun.
I love it. That's great.
Yeah. So building from the bottom up just it's that lens that you look through. It's how you see things and how you can use them like other things that you know, or create something brand new. Thanks so much for listening. If you have additional answers or comments about this question, please send them our way. And if you have a question you'd like us to tackle, we would love to hear it. You can find the submission link and anything we discussed in today's episode in the show notes. Find the show notes and past episodes at onteambuilding.com/askpodcast. That's onteambuilding.com/askpodcast.
You can find me and sign up for my newsletter at training-wheels.com.
You can sign up for my Fun Doing Fridays activity email and find me at onteambuilding.com.
We hope you join us next week for Ask Michelle and Chris About Team Building.